at least. That much is, I think, pretty well known and accepted. And I think Roy really pushed for them to be executed and to make a statement. And you know, basically manipulated the whole legal system and the judge and all that. And that's a really good example of what kind of person he was as a political operative. And again, this is a tradition, sort of, in a way, there is a, if you are interested in genealogy of American populist rights, there is a line going from Joseph McCarthy, Roy Cohn, you know, Richard Nixon, Roger Stone, Paul Manafort, Ronald Reagan, and over to Mr. Trump.
Acclaimed Iranian-Danish filmmaker Ali Abbasi directs The Apprentice, which opens today in theaters around the country and the world. The film stars Sebastian Stan as Donald Trump, Jeremy Strong as Roy Cohen, Strong's famous for starring in the Succession TV series, and Maria Bakalova, who plays Trump's first wife, Ivana. The film also deals with Ivana's allegations that Trump raped her. Trump's lawyers have sent Ali Abbasi a cease and desist order. Visit democracynow.org to see our interviews with Trump's niece, Mary, and nephew, Fred. Happy birthday to Miguel Noguera. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
Tuned in to listener-supported community radio.
Support for KBOO comes from KBOO members and Grendel's Coffee Shop, located at East Burnside and 8th Avenue in Portland, featuring coffee, tea, sandwiches, and more. Information at grendelspdx.com.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, a trans and queer supportive center celebrates its grand opening tonight in Portland.
Oregonians still have until Tuesday to register to vote.
And in international news, the Lebanese Prime Minister Najib Mikati calls for an immediate ceasefire.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, October 11th, 2024. I'm Hannah Francis.
And I'm Eliza Yurkov. Tonight is the grand opening of the Trans and Queer Supportive Center by the Marie Equi Center, a new day center for houseless people. The center is located in Southeast Portland at 4434 Southeast 25th Avenue. The Trans and Queer Supportive Center will start serving people Monday to Friday from 1 p.m. to 5 p.m. They'll offer service staff that provides help getting health insurance, food stamps, connection to housing, shelter services, and community works projects and peer support. Hygiene services at the center are coming in 2025, including showers and laundry. The Marie Equi Center is a decade-old LGBT organization that was originally created to provide queer and trans-specific medical care. They've recently been leased a building in June that has access to shelter, showers, and other resources expanding upon their tools they have to help their community. The Trans and Queer Supportive Center was partially funded by the Metro Supportive Housing Services Tax. The center will provide peer support and health workers at the site and also a place for people to simply sit and decompress off the street. Center Director Katie Cox told the Portland Mercury, quote, "As people navigate the transition from being housed to, from being unhoused to being housed, they often feel like they lose their community of folks that they were living with unsheltered. The more we can start to bridge those gaps early on and create that community building, the more successful we'll be at keeping people housed," end quote.
The November election is just 25 days away, but it's not too late to register to vote. Oregonians have until Tuesday, October 15th, to get registered to vote, either by filling out a voter registration form online or by going to their county elections office. Eligible voters in Washington have a bit more time. Online and mail registrations in Washington need to happen by October 28th. But if Washington residents want to register in person, they can do that up to Election Day, November 5th. Portland voters will get to use a different type of voting for city council and mayoral candidates. They'll be ranking their candidates 1 through 6, with 1 being their top choice. If their top choice doesn't garner enough support, then their vote gets transferred to their second choice, and so on. Ranked choice voting experts say to make the most of the new systems, voters should try to use all 6 rankings if they can. But voters shouldn't rank any candidates that they oppose, because if their other choices get eliminated, that candidate would get their support. Oregonians across the state will consider ballot measure 117, which could create ranked choice voting for state and federal elected officials, too.
Lebanese Prime Minister Najib Mikati calls for an immediate ceasefire between Israel and Hezbollah after an Israeli airstrike killed 22 people and injured more than 100 yesterday. Hezbollah, an Iran-backed political group, has maintained de facto control over southern Lebanon since the Lebanon War in 2006. The most recent conflict started last year on October 8th when Hezbollah fired rockets at Israeli positions, which it said was in solidarity with Palestine. The newest violence escalated in September when Israel sent explosive pagers to Lebanon, killing 42 people and injuring thousands. Hezbollah agreed to a ceasefire 4 days after Israel started an aerial bombing campaign on September 23rd, but Israel only scaled up its attacks. Just last week, French President Emmanuel Macron called for a halt on arms deliveries to Israel and criticized Israel's decision to send ground troops into Lebanon. UN Chief Antonio Guterres also condemned Israel for multiple targeted shootings of UN peacekeepers in southern Lebanon. Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu said, quote, "Israel will win with or without their support," end quote. Thousands have been injured and millions have been displaced due to the ongoing violence. Hezbollah agrees with Prime Minister Mikati that a ceasefire is urgently necessary to end the violence. Mohammed Afif, a Hezbollah spokesperson, said, quote, "Our absolute priority now is to defeat the enemy and force them to stop the aggression," end quote.
Mayoral candidate and public safety commissioner Rene Gonzalez says that he wants at least 1,000 cops on the street of Portland as soon as possible. In September, Willamette Weekly reported that Portland Police Bureau had the lowest number of employees in more than 20 years. There are currently 794 sworn officers in Portland. There are 881 positions currently approved by the city and 86 vacancies. There have been several efforts to bolster the officers' numbers over the last few years, but they have been derailed by waves of retirement. From 2021 to 2022, the Bureau hired 203 officers, but 287 officers retired in the same time frame. Why would the Police Bureau be hiring more positions than they can fill? Gonzalez wants more funding for the $256 million Police Bureau budget. This is part of his agenda to make Portland the, quote, "safest city in America," unquote. In 2022, budget analysts found that more funding for the police bureau was not helping recruit officers and encouraged the bureau to take greater initiative in recruitment. The city's budget office did release a statement saying that the bureau's current budgeting is unsustainable and the city will have to decide if the bureau can get more funding sources or if they need to reduce services. Dan Handelman of watchdog group Portland Cop Watch says that the police bureau has had the same number of recruits in retraining, more or less, over the years, and that the city should wait for these officers to be out of training to assess their effectiveness before talking about funding more officers. Portland Street Response has reduced PPB's annual call load by 4% of police calls. Portland Street Response operates with only 6% of their staff numbers and on a budget that is only 3% the size of PPB's.
Portland City Council voted unanimously to save the Keller Auditorium and build a new venue around Portland State University yesterday. Built in 1917, the Keller Auditorium is seismically unsafe and needs upgrades to continue hosting cultural and art events. 2 plans were proposed to the city commissioners earlier this year, one to retrofit the auditorium and the other to build an entirely new venue. The commissioners voted to move forward with both plans so as not to disrupt the theatrical production schedule, since Keller is the only venue that can host traveling Broadway shows. Keller will remain open in Keller will remain in operation as the new building is constructed on PSU's downtown campus. Renovations will start on the over 100-year-old building once the new building is finished. With a preliminary price tag set at $857 million, the city needs to conduct a market feasibility study to determine if there is enough demand for two major performing arts centers before the work can begin. Over half the cost is expected to come from local and state funding, and $100 million from philanthropic giving. If the plan moves forward, the new building is set to open in 2029, and the Keller Auditorium is set to reopen in 2031.
Civil rights groups push for a voter registration deadline extension in Georgia. Federal workers helping in hurricane recovery face misinformation and threats of violence. And Brown University rejects student divestment demands. With more on the story, it's Catherine Carley with 2024 Talks.
Welcome to 2024 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
I think it's important that every qualified Georgian has an opportunity to register, and not because of acts of God or forces of nature should they be stopped.
President of the Georgia NAACP, Gerald Griggs, says his group will keep pushing for an extension to the state's voter registration deadline following Hurricane Helene. He says widespread power outages and travel disruptions are hampering sign-up. A federal judge has so far denied their request but is asking for more evidence. A similar motion was denied in Florida. South Carolina extended its deadline to October 14th. Meanwhile, Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas says conspiracy theories about federal workers are hurting rescue and recovery efforts.
We have seen people reticent, reluctant to access the relief to which they are entitled and which will help them because of the fear that that false information has instilled in them.
Online threats of violence and anti-Semitic posts directed at FEMA officials claim the government is seizing property and stealing donations. Mayorkas calls the situation demoralizing for those risking their lives to save others. President Joe Biden says Congress should return early to pass more disaster aid. He warns that while FEMA has the resources it needs, emergency funds for small businesses are running low.
They're going to have to come back after the election as well, because this is going to be a long haul for total rebuilding.
But House Speaker Mike Johnson says it's too close to the election and states need more time to calculate their needs. Fulton County, Georgia, is suing the State Board of Elections, saying it's appointing election deniers as poll monitors in the Democratic area. Board member Janelle King counters they are defending election integrity in spite of county efforts.
There's something to having a county who refuses to respond to us, who refuses to do the things that we've asked them to do.
Georgia's Republican Secretary of State says the board is overstepping its authority, including when it requires the hand counting of all ballots. Vice President Kamala Harris confirmed she'll take part in a CNN town hall-style event in Pennsylvania on October 23rd. That's the date CNN had planned to air a second presidential candidates debate, which former President Donald Trump declined. Brown University has voted against divesting from companies with financial ties to Israel. The school had agreed last spring to consider a proposal in exchange for the removal of a student Gaza protest camp. Nayanta Nepal is the student council president.
Just because the bureaucracy of this university does not agree with divestment doesn't mean that students will stop fighting for divestment, will stop fighting for the fact that there are still people dying on the ground right now.
Brown was one of a few universities to peacefully negotiate with student activists. I'm Catherine Carley for Pacifica Network and Public News Service.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Counterspin. At 6, it's Rising Up with Sonali. Then at 7, KBOO presents Running On Air, a daily roundtable discussion with candidates running to represent Portland. On tonight's episode, we'll be talking to two candidates for mayor. Tonight's weather will be partly cloudy with a low of 53 degrees. Tomorrow's weather will be sunny with a high of 75 degrees. Today in history, live from New York, it's 1975. America's most popular sketch show, Saturday Night Live, debuts on NBC 49 years ago. The quote of the day is from scholar and philosopher Friedrich Nietzsche. A monster lover he was not, as he warned against their sympathy, saying, quote, "Whoever fights monsters should see to it that in the process he does not become a monster. And if you gaze long enough into an abyss, the abyss will gaze back into you."
Fraudulent sober living homes in Arizona have been deceiving tribal members. The Navajo Nation is trying to bring them home. Governor Gretchen Whitmer declared Friday, October 11th, to be Native American Veterans Day in Michigan. And the grassroots group Protect the Sacred is hosting a Native Vote event on the Navajo Nation this weekend with Hollywood stars. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The Navajo Nation is continuing its efforts to bring home tribal members who were deceived by fraudulent sober living homes in Arizona. The homes targeted Native people with false promises of assistance and left them stranded. KSUT Tribal Radio's Crystal Ashke reports.
Vulnerable tribal members were lured with false promises of treatment for substance abuse. Instead of receiving the care they were promised, they were caught in a scam that defrauded Arizona's Medicaid program of nearly $3 billion. Thousands were left struggling with untreated addiction and stranded far from home, many on the streets, while their families were unaware of their whereabouts. In response, the Navajo Nation launched Operation Rainbow Bridge, an initiative to help bring home the estimated 5,000 to 7,000 tribal members affected by the fraud. Lieutenant Robert Williams of the Navajo Nation Police Department says this is an ongoing effort to locate relatives and loved ones who remain stranded in the Phoenix area.
When I talk about our relatives and loved ones, I'm not just talking about Diné people. I'm talking about any Native relative we might have down there in that area. During Operation Rainbow Bridge, we did encounter members of other nations. And I know we encountered some folks in Cherokee Nation and some other nations further back east. So that effort continues to provide resources for those family members and loved ones who want to get home out of that situation.
Despite the crackdown on these fraudulent operations, Williams says authorities are still investigating reports that some facilities continue to operate and target tribal members.
I think we'd be naive to say we stopped it because it's driven by money. There are greedy people who want money, and stopping that, you know, that's a lot of the cause of criminality is that greed. So we have to remain ever vigilant to protect those who are maybe having trouble protecting themselves, maybe due to addictions, alcohol or drug addictions. You know, they might not be able to help themselves at that moment in time when these people contact them. We will constantly keep our eyes and ears out, and we ask the public to do the same. Let's look for people who are unscrupulous and are willing to take advantage of those people who are just ravaged by addiction.
Arizona lawmakers this year failed to pass legislation to tighten regulations governing these facilities. They are expected to consider new legislation in 2025. I'm Crystal Ashke.
Michigan Governor Gretchen Whitmer declared Friday, October 11th, Native American Veterans Day in the state. The day honors Native American men and women who have served in the armed forces of the U.S. The proclamation states Native American communities have fostered the warrior spirit that exemplifies the qualities of strength, honor, pride, devotion, and wisdom, with Native Americans enlisting at higher rates per capita than any other ethnic group. The day is also to draw awareness to challenges Native veterans face today, including access to health care and benefits. According to the governor's office, there are more than 140,000 Native American veterans living in the U.S. and Puerto Rico, with more than 2,500 in Michigan. The grassroots group Protect the Sacred is hosting a Native Vote event on the Navajo Nation this weekend with Hollywood stars. The Walk to the Polls, honoring 100 years of citizenship and beyond, is an effort to mobilize Native voters. The event is scheduled to take place Saturday in Fort Defiance and Window Rock, Arizona, and is expected to feature Native and non-Native celebrities and tribal leaders. The group has hosted other Native Vote events, including bull riding, skateboarding, and a horse ride to the polls. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Leaders in Savannah, Georgia, say federal investments are helping the city recover from Hurricane Helene and building resilience against future climate threats. Initiatives like solar energy expansion and community resilience C-hubs are also creating jobs and strengthening the local economy. Shantia Hudson has more on the story.
Savannah leaders are pointing out the ways that federal dollars are being used to boost the area's resilience against climate change. In the aftermath of Hurricane Helene, many residents are just now getting their power back after a week in the dark. Mayor Van Johnson says the storm has been a wake-up call for the urgent need to tackle climate change, and Savannah's resilience plan is designed to do just that.
In 2020, the city council unanimously adopted a 100% Savannah initiative, which for us means transitioning partially to clean energy in the 2030s and totally by 2050.
Mayor Johnson says 75% of the city's buildings are at risk of flooding and 26% face wildfire threats. Despite these challenges, he notes the efforts to build climate resilience have boosted the local economy, with jobs popping up in solar energy, construction, and renewable technology. Savannah is a part of a statewide initiative that recently received $156 million from the Solar for All program, part of the Inflation Reduction Act. This funding, spread across Georgia, aims to expand solar energy over the next 5 years. Nicole Lee with Be Smart Home Solutions says their efforts have already helped local families lower energy costs.
Thomas is one of our very first clients to get the solar with the Georgia Bright program. They have seen savings of more than 50% on their power bills. Just this summer, they've seen a bill of $18 through solar plus storage.
She says the solar system proved invaluable during Hurricane Helene, allowing them to power critical medical devices and even serve as a resiliency hub for their neighbors. Chatham County Commissioner Aaron Whiteley emphasizes the importance of preparedness in the face of future storms, pointing out new projects aimed at enhancing community resilience.
Chatham County is working on community resiliency hubs that will provide power during the outages, like the ones we experienced last week.
Officials say these efforts are also crucial to protect vulnerable communities from the health impacts of climate change. Other projects in the works include what's known as beach renourishment, a drainage basin study, and forging more partnerships with other organizations to bolster the region's preparedness. For Georgia News Connection, I'm Shantia Hudson. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
The Environmental Protection Agency has finalized a new rule on lead in drinking water, which includes a 10-year deadline for most utilities to replace lead service lines. Funding from the bipartisan infrastructure law could help accelerate the process, but critics point out that the rule doesn't apply to schools. KBOO's Zachary Jones Nure has more.
Groups that advocate for clean water are applauding the EPA's new rule on replacing lead pipes, but they warn that the drinking water in schools remains at risk. The agency has set a 10-year deadline for most utilities to replace lead service lines, but omitted requirements for schools to replace the water fountains or plumbing that have lead components. John Rumpler with the Environment America Research and Policy Center says it's up to school superintendents and legislators to ensure students' water is safe.
This final rule now dispels the illusion that the federal government is going to come and do the clean water homework for the state.
The Wyoming Department of Environmental Quality in 2021 offered a voluntary program funded by the EPA to test drinking water in state schools and childcare facilities. According to results published in February, of over 250 tests, a dozen led to the start of remediation projects. Only three were completed. Several decades after the dangers of lead pipes were established, more than 9 million remain in use. The toxic metal is particularly dangerous for children and can lead to brain or nervous system damage, delayed development, and behavioral problems. Rumbler says the EPA missed an opportunity to better protect students, although a growing number of states and cities are now requiring lead filtration systems.
This final rule now dispels the illusion that the federal government is going to come and do the clean water homework for the state.
To help rural towns and cities comply with the new rule, the EPA is making an additional $3 billion available through the bipartisan infrastructure law. The measure initially provided $15 billion to help cities replace their lead pipes, but government officials estimate the total cost will be several times higher. For KBOO News and the Public News Service, I'm Zachary Jones-Nure.
The U.S. Postal Service is rolling out its next-generation delivery vehicles that are fully electric mail trucks. Among other design changes, conservation groups say the trucks reduce the USPS carbon footprint as well as its noise pollution, and they add street safety. KBOO's Zachary Jones-Nuray has more.
Neighborhoods across the U.S. will soon be cleaner and quieter as the U.S. Postal Service rolls out its new electric mail delivery trucks. The USPS received $3 billion in funding from the Inflation Reduction Act to electrify its fleet, the largest in the country. Kathleen Garcia with the Sierra Club says the next generation delivery vehicles will not only fight climate change, but also reduce noise pollution for the 45 million Americans who live in close proximity to a road or other transport infrastructure.
A lot of these vehicles just go a short distance every single day, and then they return back to the hub where they can easily be charged. And so it just makes a lot of common sense.
New Mexico is one of the 13 states that have mandated adoption of electric vehicles. To that end, the state's, quote, clean car tax credit officially launched on October 1st. It allows who bought a clean car as of May 2024 to apply for state tax credits for the purchase. Up to $3,000 in credits are available for individuals or businesses. Many people have commented on the odd appearance of the new vehicles, which, compared to predecessors, have much larger windshields and bumpers and a hood that some say resembles a duckbill. Garcia says there's a good reason for the modifications.
The design changes were made to ensure the safety of the driver and the safety of folks that are around the vehicle, other drivers, pedestrians, bicyclists, to really make sure that they're moving around the town safely.
Within the next few years, the USPS expects to replace its current fleet, introduced 40 years ago, with 60,000 new vehicles, most of them electric models, across all 50 states. The new EVs features airbags, 360-degree cameras, blind spot monitoring, collision sensors, and anti-lock brakes. For KBOO News and the Public News Service, I'm Zachary Jones-Murray.
Wild rice is an ecologically important and culturally revered wetland species native to the Great Lakes region and was a staple for indigenous peoples. Over the past two centuries, a range of factors have decimated wild rice beds, but there is now renewed enthusiasm for restoration programs. Mike Moen has more on the story.
Across the Great Lakes region, there's a growing interest among Native American tribes to revive wild rice harvesting, including in Wisconsin. Closely intertwined with indigenous culture and identity, this important resource was decimated after the arrival of European settlers. But today, many partners are supporting initiatives to restore wild rice beds. Joe Gravine leads such efforts for the Lac du Flambeau Band of Lake Superior Chippewa Indians in northern Wisconsin. He says as their work began to produce positive results, it was a joy to see excitement among fellow harvesters.
And I see that abundance of rice that hasn't been there for 20 years, that smile on her face, the energy that they give off.
Over the past couple of centuries, activities like indiscriminate logging, dam building, and mining played a role in wiping out the presence of wild rice. Despite the recent revival, new threats like climate change have emerged that could affect the plant's future. That's prompted calls for more research and funding to build on recent success stories. Gravine suggests they're at a crucial point in scaling up harvesting, noting that inconsistent weather patterns complicate the management plans.
You know, we're getting these major storms, rainstorms, whatever, you know, right when the rice is ripe.
In some cases, teams are combining emerging data with cultural instincts to monitor growing trends and get a sense of how future seasons will play out. Many partners are supporting the restoration work, including state, federal, and intertribal agencies, universities, and non-government organizations. This is Mike Moen for Wisconsin News Connection. This story was produced with original reporting from Swarthy Rahman for Manga Bay.
Jeannie Ortiz-Ortiz lived through Hurricane Maria. She now offers free legal assistance to disaster survivors. Dr. Anthony Lizowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Jeannie Ortiz-Ortiz is from Puerto Rico. She was living on the island studying for the bar exam when Hurricane Maria struck in 2017. After the devastating storm, she saw firsthand the legal and administrative challenges people faced, applying for relief aid, negotiating with insurance, or replacing vital documents.
I started helping a family member whose apartment was damaged navigate FEMA's requirements because she only spoke Spanish. And after that, I also helped my employer at the time in applying for the Small Business Administration's disaster loan program. And I was struck by the length of the process and the numerous requirements.
Her legal expertise helped her provide much-needed assistance, and the experience helped shape the path of her career. Today, Ortiz-Ortiz is a vice director of the American Bar Association's Disaster Legal Services Program, which provides free legal aid to survivors.
It means a lot to be able to understand the tragedy of a disaster and be able to use my skills as a lawyer to do something to support that recovery.
And she says there's a growing need for free legal services in multiple languages as disasters grow more common in a warming world.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Friday, October 11th, 2024. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Althea Billings, Eliza Yurkov, Hannah Francis, Morgan, and Zachary Jones-Nure. The producer is Eliza Yurkov, and our engineer is Jasmine Moss. Special thanks to Kathleen Shannon, Antonia Gonzalez, Mike Moen, Ross Brown, Pearl Stark, Dr. Anthony Lizawatz, Catherine Carley, and Shintia Hudson. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Hannah Francis.
And I'm Eliza Yurkov. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are supported by our members. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for Counterspin.